The now former Guardian columnist Louisa Dillner is also here in the studio. She's the author of a new book, Love by Numbers, The Hidden Facts Behind Relationships. Louisa, welcome.
Hi.
She's the head of new product development at the British Medical Journal Group and, according to her press release, has a perfect relationship. Fair to say, Louisa, you're like an agony aunt with a scientific footing. Is that about fair?
The columns I wrote were a sort of attempt to answer questions in a rather different way. I think traditionally agony aunts answered questions from their own experience of life and often their own experience of being marital therapists. But the book's really more about trying to provide some evidence.
So the idea was that people would write in with their usual relationship queries, my boyfriend doesn't like me anymore, or I think my husband is having an affair, that kind of thing. And you would, instead of saying, well, what you need to do is sit down and talk, is go around, look for studies that maybe have analysed this in some way and give them a statistical type answer.
Yeah, well, this started from when I was working at the British Medical Journal, and we were really big on evidence-based medicine. And the idea is that we would help doctors, give doctors information about the latest evidence so that they could make decisions about how to treat patients. And then we actually went on to develop that information for patients so that we had information that would help patients decide what treatments to take based on the best available evidence. And I was on the tube one day and I could hear these women chatting, as you do, and one of them was saying, oh, you know, my boyfriend's left me and, you know, we've been together for 2 years and I wonder whether he's going to come back. You know, he just sort of left, said that the relationship was over. And her friend was saying, oh, I'm sure he will. You know, you've been together for so long. And, you know, just wait and I'm sure it'll be all right. And I remember thinking, well, how do you know? You know, what's the evidence that, you know, for that? You're telling somebody to wait. And actually, maybe that's not true.
Did you row in with, well, statistically, 18%
well,
of people
yeah.
do come back?
Well, I didn't know that. So, but it did make me think, is there any evidence out there for this sort of thing? And of course, when you go and look, there's lots of research papers in social psychology journals, and they're the sort of journals that people don't bump into. And actually, in fairness, when you go and look at these papers, they're very long, they're very dense. It's kind of quite hard to pick out a sort of nugget of information. So it's about translating them in a way that people can understand.
So let's go through some of the examples then. So let's go through the whole dating to marriage to death scenario. So you like somebody, you see them. What kind of help could you give someone who's dating from your vast experience of statistical analysis of these things?
I think sometimes the dating thing in some ways is the easiest bit. So, I mean,
it really isn't, trust me.
I mean, you start, you know, by meeting somebody, and the common places are meeting through friends at work, in the gym, and in pubs.
Well,
that depends. It's a good question about that, because it's not a bad place to meet somebody, but if it goes wrong, it's a terrible place to meet somebody. What made me laugh when I was looking through the research is that people are so lazy that the chances of you meeting somebody on your own floor for a relationship are massively higher than even the floor below.
Well, we've just moved offices. There's a huge number of people. We're sitting next to sport, so I'm not sure there's going to be
I think there's not a lot of dating potential there. And similarly, you are quite likely to meet people through friends. And one of the things that I often used to say when advising people was, you know, tell your friends that you're looking for somebody because they're pretty well placed to try and network and find people for you. And of course, you don't meet anyone sitting in your front room.
Okay, so you're on a date with someone. Is there any advice you can give someone about whether they like you or not? Are you talking about specific individual things about body language and things, or is it more about what kind of strategies? I mean,
well, the evidence about what strategies you should adopt when you meet somebody are that you should be yourself. I mean, that's what you have to be. And to try and impress somebody too much or to be rather sort of desperate is clearly sort of off-putting. And some of these studies are around speed dating, for example. There's been a huge amount of studying around speed dating because it's very easy to look at what sort of things appeal. And, of course, first of all, it is the, you know, how tall is somebody? How good-looking is somebody? How much do you think somebody might earn? It is those sort of rather ghastly sort of basic sort of evolutionary things that you're interested in. But then it is also about sort of humour and personality, and those are things that matter. And I think being able to convey that is very useful. I mean, for women, there was this big thing for a long time that you couldn't be a smart woman and get a date. And there's quite a lot of evidence from the States looking at the amount that women earn correlated with, you know, their relationship status that shows that that's not true. So sometimes you can think that something's going to go against you and it doesn't. And I did have this terribly sad question marks from this woman saying, you know, should I act stupid to get a date? And you think, well, when are you suddenly going to, you know, not be stupid? Like, you know, pretend you've been away for some sort of, you know, short degree course.
there was an interesting question also that I read in your book about whether men supposedly prefer blondes to brunettes or not. And what I enjoyed about that, the answer to that was, well, obviously there's no actual necessarily an answer to that now. But the fact is that perhaps... men do prefer blondes because they stood out more on the savannah, is that right?
Well, that's what they say, isn't it? No, that's what they say. They say that in, sort of more ice age times, you could see sort of blonde hair more easily than brown.
So you basically only attracted to what you can see.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, it gives you more of a fighting chance, doesn't it? You know,
James?
There is an interesting question with that. Is that culturally specific, that supposed preference? Or, you know, does that apply the world over? Presumably
apparently
not.
That diversity was more common in sort of northern Europe, so that was really sort of only an issue there. And what was interesting about the study is that, you know, men said, oh, I really like, they sort of went for women who had the same colour hair as them, not the evolutionary studies, but the more recent studies. But still blondes were attributed with being, you know, sort of ditzy, you know, but also attractive, but not necessarily the sort of person you'd want to go out with.
What you were saying earlier on about the love on different floors of the building now explains why I've seen Andy sharking around on the fourth floor. I was wondering what he was doing up there.
That's the management floor, isn't it?
That's where the cash is. That's right. I just wanted to ask a slightly sort of devil's advocate question, really. I mean, from your background at the BMJ, I mean, obviously you're used to dealing with, you know, really hardcore evidence-based medicine. Some of the sort of studies on this kind of topic in those social psychology journals are perhaps a little bit flaky. Did you have to do a massive kind of filtering job to filter out those things that were, you know, although they purported to show a certain thing, actually were not useful studies?
I mean, what I try to do in the book is to give some qualifying comments about the evidence. But that's a really quite a hot topic in social psychology because there's a big awareness that a lot of the study designs are not very good. For example, they'll often use their undergraduate students, and is a undergraduate from Berkeley, you know, like a sort of 40-year-old woman from Streatham? I mean, probably not. And also the studies tend to take sort of snapshot in time. So they're not longitudinal studies that will follow somebody up and see what's happened to them. They go, right, that's how it is now. There's also a huge sort of fallout from these studies, and you don't never know whether people have dropped out because they're happy or they're unhappy. And often there isn't a sort of statistical analysis that allows for that. But at the end of the day, you know, you can't have randomised controlled trials where you go, you know, you're blinded, you're going to fall in love and marry this bloke, and you're going to have kids with that bloke, you're going to divorce. I mean, you can't do a randomised control study, but you probably could. And I think there's quite a lot of pressure that social psychologists are putting on themselves to do the best studies that they can. So apparently sort of less than 10% of studies are longitudinal studies where you follow somebody up. But then I guess you'd have to start with, you know, here you are at 10, what sort of relationships are you going to have? And that's because there are so many variables. I mean, if you put somebody on a drug, you can say, well, you're this age, you've got this condition. Mm. And even in drugs, people worry that they don't take account the trials of people who have more than one condition. But here you've got somebody whose parents might have split up. That's quite a big indicator for the likelihood that you're going to stay with somebody. There'll be people who have got stress in their jobs who might, you know, drink quite a lot. The couples who've got little kids. I mean, all these things sort of impact. It's quite hard to separate out.
There was one particular question that sort of caught my eye about the best month to have a baby. Is there a best month?
No. There isn't, is there? I mean, there isn't a best month. I mean, you know, August, somebody did ask that. But, I mean, if you really took the question really seriously, you know, a lot of months epidemiologists have found various conditions associated with a child born in, you know, May as opposed to September. And I think you can't really, I mean, I think you should just take into account the fact that it's quite nice to have a baby in summer because you can go out and walk it in the sun as opposed to trying to struggle through the snow. It's not going to make a huge amount of difference to your child's life.
Well, with all those caveats then, let's go to a couple of more examples of the kinds of things you were tackling in the book. So these classic questions, things like, Do chat up lines work? Is there anything called a 7-year itch? Let's go into those.
Okay, so I think chat up lines is interesting, okay, because there were, and these are survey studies, so they're not, you know, fantastic studies, but it's quite a simple thing to find out. I mean, what one of the studies did was it provided a sort of hypothetical scenario, and those are my least favourite, because what you're saying to somebody is, what do you think you'd do, not what would you do, and then watching them do it. But what they did was they asked undergraduates the sort of chat-up lines that were most successful, and the ones that worked were ones that were a question. So if you sort of said, well, you know, hi, what do you think about this, or, you know, what's your... The examples they gave were from speed dating again, and one was, what's your favourite pizza topping, or, you know, but apparently that really works. You can use that, okay?
but sort of say better than rowing in with, you know, the Israeli Palestine crisis or something like that.
Yeah, I think take it down a bit intensity wise, or, you know. So asking a question that's sort of open, that gives somebody a chance to respond, rather than sort of wailing in with something that's a statement, is better. Then one of the scenarios involves somebody saying, I own this bar, do you want to dance? And clearly that went down quite well, apparently, because it showed not only could he dance, which is unusual, but also that he owned the bar.
But asking someone to dance doesn't necessarily mean you can dance,
well,
surely.
What if that's not true? Well, what if you don't happen to own a bar?
Well, yeah, so it's a hypothetical question. Actually, there's a whole literature about people, you know, how they lie to get a date, which I haven't gone into. But I think it is useful to think. And also, men often have quite sexual sort of chat-up lines, and that tends not to go down very well with women.
Ian?
So, like, can you say, like, is that your own hair or something like that? I mean, what sort of question?
That's perfect.
Are they your own teeth?
Are they your own teeth? Yeah. No, I just thought.
You can get the hang of it very quickly.
I've got you're supposed to chat up people, not actually say what you're thinking.
Them, yeah.
Not say what you're thinking.
Wait, look, I've got a female friend who'll remain anonymous. Right. She's saying to me she doesn't know where to find a man, and I was wondering if you have any advice for someone who looks around on their floor of the office, and I can understand what she's saying. There isn't much to pick from. And she says her friends of her friends aren't particularly appealing for her. She's a lovely girl. She doesn't know where to go to find men. Well, I've said, given her loads of places, go climbing, because lots of men go climbing. I said, or go surfing, lots of men go surfing, or just things, you know, interesting sort of hobby things. And she says, well, I don't want to go climbing, I don't want to go surfing, I don't want to sort of coerce myself into doing some hobby I'm not interested in, purely to find a man. And I thought, well, fair point, but I didn't have any other answers for
her. What about internet?
Her.
Has she tried internet dating?
Well, I said, just get a man off the internet. And her worry about the internet was that it was full of men who were just after one thing.
And what would that be?
Sex.
All men are after one thing, whether they're on the internet or not.
Is it bad?
Is what bad?
That.
What? No.
I feel like he's getting some sort of psychotherapy right now. I think this isn't what he's meant to. It's meant to be private, the sort of thing. Ian. As I
no,
said
no,
to you.
But I'm, you know, just sort of putting sex to one side for a minute. I mean, people can lie on the internet, but also you can have quite sort of honest discussions on the internet, and you can... You know, it's still the same rules of safety apply. So if you meet somebody outside of the internet, that you can, you know, make sure you're safe. But there's a good study from Bath University showing that the rates of having a reasonably long-term relationship were pretty good. I can't remember what they were, but they were pretty good.
One of the more interesting and maybe perhaps shocking stats in the book was about poaching people from relationships. So the idea is, you know, that if someone is in a relationship and you quite fancy them, you have a 50% chance that they'll come to you if you just ask them to go out with you.
Yeah,
so you're
shocking.
Going out with someone else.
Shocking.
Why don't you come out with me? And half the time they'll say yes. I mean, that can't be true. Well, it is true, clearly, because it's the study.
Yeah, it was a good. It was a good study. It was sort of over. You know, it was actually sort of a global study. And I don't think it was every time you asked that you had a 50% chance. I think it was overall that 50% of people had said that they had been successfully poached at some time. And so she could also try poaching. I mean, it's not a very pleasant thing to do, but a lot of people do that just precisely because they feel there aren't a lot of people out there, and they're all taken.
There's a kind of quality control there that, you know, if this man's already in a relationship, he must be all right. You know, not a complete lunatic.
Yeah, I suppose.
Or sex maniac like Ian.
I thought this was a really interesting stat, actually. And incidentally, I think she's done with any poachings that she may have done. I'm sure she hasn't done it. But what... what I thought was interesting about this 50% figure was that isn't maybe it the case that for someone to try and poach someone else, they must be pretty damn sure that they want to put the person through it. And the person to leave must be pretty damn sure the other person is going to be quite a good prospect. So maybe if you're single, you sort of go out with anything that comes along. Whereas if you're in a relationship, to leave that relationship to chance with someone else, maybe, you know, the chance of it, you know, 50% chance of it working out is pretty good. Maybe if they were single, it'd be 20%. I don't know.
I think that's fair. I mean, people who are willing to be poached and to poach are meant to sort of have certain characteristics. So they're meant to be a bit sort of, you know, to be much more sort of extrovert and able to talk about sex and stuff. And, you know, I mean, clearly get intimate reasonably quickly, chatty, and then clearly more intimate later on.
Do long distance relationships work?
Well, the evidence is quite conflicting on this, actually, with some studies showing that they do and some that they don't. I mean, generally, the long-distance relationships that tend to work are the ones where the intention is always that they're going to come back together again, and generally within sort of, you know, 3 to 5 years. And then when we look at those studies of couples who have been apart and then moved back together again, they generally do all right, so they tend to stay together. But some of the secrets about when you're living apart are that you have to get over the jealousy thing, and actually couples who are, you know, live pretty close to each other feel jealous sometimes. And you also have to make sure that you talk about everyday things, so not on the phone just about, you know, really sort of extreme feelings, and but, you know, the fact that you've run out of milk or something happened at work, so that you have to keep that sort of level of normal intimacy going. But long distance relationships can work, but, you know, you can't put too much pressure on them. Don't expect every weekend together to be sublime.
And you're a man who constantly talks about feelings and deep emotions and things, I hear. You've got some questions?
Yeah, I was just wondering, obviously you've looked at an awful lot of studies that have been done on relationships and brought them together in your book. I mean, do you think that together these studies actually can really help people in their relationships? I mean, do you think there is something to be drawn from this, which actually there are some serious bits of guidance in there?
Yeah, I think there are. And I'd say it certainly informed me, I think. I mean, sometimes you can read a whole study and think, well, you know, is that so obvious that I didn't need to read this? And you can sift through all the statistics and think, well, you know, are they really representative of my life? But there are some sort of truisms, I think, that come through all the research. And I think one is how you treat the other person in terms of, you know, how you talk to them, how you communicate with them. And John Gottman, who runs a love lab in the States, he's a very well-respected researcher, he says you should always say 5 good things to 1 negative thing. And actually, when you think about it, that's sort of, you know, quite challenging. And he also says that contempt is a sulfuric acid of relationships. And I think that's really true as well. And then there's research about arguing, and I think sometimes couples think if they argue, they haven't got a good relationship. But arguing is fine. You just, when you argue, you have to stick to the specifics. Don't drag in stuff from 5 years ago, and don't call each other hurtful names that you'll never recover from. And I think there are some sort of pretty good tips in there that can help you lead your life. I mean, one of the things that I think I used to be guilty of was what he calls harsh startup, where you start sort of yelling. You don't sort of introduce the issue in a calm, constructive, nice way that takes account of the other person's feelings. You just sort of go for it. And I think sort of moderating how you are and thinking of the other person is pretty helpful.
That's easy to say in a love lab, but if you're just angry, introducing concepts in a very calm, rational way seems quite difficult. Louisa, we'll go through maybe one more example. Right now, the economic climate is dire, weather's terrible, everything. How do those sorts of things affect the way that we see the rest of the world, for example, and relationships with people? Do they affect these things? Yeah. Do we take more comfort in them, for example?
They do have repercussions. They do affect relationships. It's a bit different. If there's a general recession, then what tends to happen is the impact of a person being made redundant. They don't feel so much, this is about me, you know, I'm a failure in my life, what's gone wrong, because they see it happening to everybody else. And in some ways, that puts less of a pressure on their relationship. But typically, if you are made redundant, if you worry about your job, people tend to drink more, they tend to sort of smirk, they tend to eat badly, can't sleep, get a bit depressed. That doesn't help a relationship. And it was a study done in the UK, but using Swedish data, because the data from Scandinavian countries is always so amazingly sort of accurate and fantastic. And they found that after redundancy for the first year, there was a 18% increase in divorces in married couples, and probably more from cohabiting couples, because they tend to be a bit less stable. So it does have an impact. And of course, the way around it is to try and be aware of your partner and be as supportive as you can, and to say, look, you know, it's not your job that defines you, we'll get through this, and and to be rather sort of loving, I think.
So good news for divorce lawyers in the upcoming recession. Louisa, thank you so much. If you want the inside track on how to find a partner or just to stick with the one you've got, Louisa's book, Love by Numbers, is out this week.